Well, so now we will begin with our last presentation, in this workshop about just war theory and legal theory. We're glad to have here Victor Tadros, a professor of the University of Warwick, who is going to talk about why law and morality should converge.
Hello, I'm Victor. Thanks very much for having me. It's really nice to be here. I really like Girona. I've never been here before, and it's really pretty. And it's been really interesting today. So sorry it's going to get so much less interesting now. So lots of people in just war theory think that the facts that affect the morality of war and the current state of the laws of war diverge. So lots of acts in war which are permitted are prohibited in the law, and lots of acts which are prohibited in morality are permitted in the law. So we've got divergence in two different directions. And many people who write about the philosophy of war who accept that they diverge in this way also make arguments in favor of divergence. So they think that divergence is a good thing, because they think that the law, if it diverges from morality, will be effective in reducing the destructiveness of war. And that if we tried to make the law converge with morality, we would do worse with respect to our main ambition, which is to reduce the harmful effects of war. And I'm going to give a cautious argument for convergence on the two main ways in which we see divergence. And I say it's a cautious case because it's an empirical case. And you might think, well, what the hell is a philosopher like me doing making empirical claims? But actually, the empirical claims have a certain sort of philosophical or armchair orientation, because we can't do a test where we say, oh, well, that's like an experiment where we change the laws of war in various different ways and then see which one reduces the death toll most. That kind of empirical analysis of the laws of war isn't available to us. All we can do is try and work out the different incentive structures that having the law set up in a different way creates, and then make conjecture about what's likely to have the best effect. And indeed, that's what most people who favour divergence do. So they say, if we change the laws of war in this way and that way, we would change the incentive structures, and if we change the incentive structures in this way, we would end up with more destructive results. And then I'm going to argue along similar lines for convergence. Okay, so let's just think about the two main ways in which we see divergence. That most people now agree that it's wrong to participate in unjust wars in most cases, and there might be some exceptions. So sometimes it's okay to participate in unjust wars, but that's an exceptional case. In most cases, if the war's unjust, don't fight it. In the old days, the Michael Walzer days, which some people still remember with fondness like Itzhak, but the rest of us think of as the dark ages of just war theory, people thought that it was okay to fight in wars if your government told you to do it and you basically complied with international law. And I thought, when I came to this literature, which I didn't know until more recently, I was a criminal lawyer, and then I came across this view, which was called the traditionalist view, that it was okay to fight in wars if your government told you to do it. I just found this view just bizarre. I mean, you know, so here are these people who are trying to perpetrate this genocide and take over this other country, and here are these other people who are trying to stop them. Nothing wrong with helping the genocidal people by killing the people who are trying to prevent the genocide. It just seemed baffling to me that anyone believed this. So I was amazed that this view was a view in the literature. Good rule of thumb, don't help genocide. Note to self. Don't participate in Nazi domination of Europe. Seems like a pretty good kind of moral principle to me. So I found this view kind of surprising. And yet the law seems to be set up that's okay. So that's a case where morality prohibits conduct. Don't fight in unjust wars. says morality, but the law says it's permitted. It's not completely clear that it says it's permitted, because actually the content of international law is so unclear, we don't really know, but it seems to say something like that. The other case, which is a bit more contentious, has to do with civilian participation in unjust wars, where the law seems to prohibit, morality seems to prohibit participating in unjust wars, and that seems to make it permissible to kill people who participate in unjust wars, who are civilians and make a causal contribution to supporting the war. But the law prohibits killing these people. So you've got all these munitions workers or people who are setting up the road structure or building tanks or whatever, building other transportation or participating in the government, and they're all supporting the war effort. And we know that the war effort relies on all of this civilian resources. And morality says, don't participate in this way, don't go and support unjust wars in this way either. And it also says, if people do this, and you can prevent the threats that they contribute to by killing them, then it's okay to kill them. I think that's the right moral view, where doing so is the least harmful way of preventing unjust threats occurring. Some people think that there's some kind of causal threshold where if you have to make a big enough causal contribution to threats to justify killing the person. When people say that, I don't quite know what they mean by the different sizes of causal contributions. I do a big analysis of different things they might mean in a paper in Ethics recently, and I think that probably on all of the best accounts of what that might mean, it doesn't make much difference what the causal contributions are. Something else matters about responsibility or other things, which actually sometimes track some causal views. But independently of that, I don't think that this thesis is right. So I think generally it's okay to kill people insofar as doing so is effective in eliminating threats that people causally contribute to as part of the unjust war. But the law says something like, don't kill people unless they are they get over some kind of causal threshold. So the International Committee of the Red Cross has its interpretation of this kind of idea. It says something like, the participation has to be something like one causal step away from the threat. They don't tell us what one causal step is, and I have no idea what that means. So I read a lot of literature on the philosophy of causation, the metaphysics of causation, and no one knows how to individuate causal steps. So I just think that phrase is just meaningless. I don't think it says anything that we understand. But there is some kind of, I don't know what it is. It's like an imagined idea that someone has to be kind of close enough, and they have some examples. Like if you're transporting munitions in the country where you're fighting, then you are a legitimate target as far as the ICRC are concerned. But if you're transporting the munitions in your home country, then you're not a legitimate target. Why it makes the difference that you've crossed the border, I couldn't quite understand, but that seemed to be their view. Okay, so my view is that, at least tentatively, that the law should prohibit participating in unjust wars, and it should permit the killing of people who make the right kinds of contributions to unjust wars under certain kinds of conditions. And I'm going to spell out a little bit how to restrict that idea in a moment. And I'm more confident about the first case, the prohibition case, than I am about the permission case. Let me just give you the kind of general case for convergence. This is like some extreme level of generality. Those people that argue for divergence and say the content of the laws of war should diverge from morality, I think ignore a distinction between facts about the substantive law and facts about institutional design around the law. In the criminal law, for example, we've got a law of murder, we've got a law of theft and so on, and that's the substantive law. And then we have a bunch of prosecutorial conditions. We've got mens rea standards and we've got defences. We've got jurisdictional questions and all sorts of other things that determine how the law works. So we've got a bunch of prohibitions, don't kill people and so on, don't steal people's stuff, sometimes with mens rea standards attached and a bunch of defences. And then we've got evidential standards, so you have to get to a certain kind of standard of proof and so on. And then lots of the incentive effects that we might have in the law can be altered by altering these other institutional facts and not by permitting stuff that's morally wrong or by prohibiting stuff that's morally permissible. And I think the similar thing about the laws of war. The people who argue for divergence, I think, haven't attended to all of these different options that are available for responding to perverse incentive effects that might seem to result from getting morality and the law to converge. Some people say that we shouldn't really be doing this at all because it's immoral to think about the relationship between morality and the laws of war on the ground that if we start thinking about this stuff, then we might reduce the authority of the laws of war, and that's a dangerous game to play because we can't replace the laws of war with something else. Jeremy Waldron makes this this argument. He also makes the argument that because the laws of war have evolved over time, chances are they're pretty good. I don't think either of these arguments is successful. I think that with respect to the first one, when there's no public culture which examines a set of laws, then people tend not to have much confidence in those laws. And so the authority of law, I think, is reduced when people don't see it as being subject to public scrutiny. So I think it's a very dangerous game not to have a culture where people are scrutinizing the laws of war, because then people have much less reason to see the pros and cons of those laws and then have little confidence in them, because they just see them as a kind of power game. And actually, I think that is how many people see the laws of war. They just see them as a bunch of rules that were created by powerful actors they don't have much reason to abide by. They don't take them very seriously because they don't think there's a public culture where they've been subject to the right kind of scrutiny in the light of a proper assessment that's impartial between power differentials between states. And so they just don't, particularly people in poorer countries, I think just don't have much respect for them at all. And with respect to their evolution, I think the laws of war, many of the central components of the laws of war are just much more recent than Waldron suggests. They get adjusted over time. The development of the ICC and the shaping of the Geneva Conventions is not quite so historic as Waldron seems to suggest. And we can see that the laws of war aren't doing a very good job simply from the fact that so many people still get killed in war, and the laws of war just don't seem very effective in restraining it. So 160 million people were killed in wars in the 20th century, and it's not as if the largest war was obviously the Second World War, it's not as if we're seeing less barbaric and fierce wars being fought, and in fact we're seeing probably a higher proportion of civilians being killed in war now than has ever been the case. So there's a recent book called Are the Geneva Conventions Effective, which seems to suggest that the proportion of civilians that get killed in war compared to combatants has actually gone up, despite the fact that the Geneva Conventions prohibit it. So I don't think that we've been very effective through the laws of war in reducing the harmful effects of war. Some people think that it's inevitable that the laws of war and the morality of war will converge if the laws of war are set up justly, because they just think the facts that make the laws of war just are just the very facts that make up the morality of war. They think something like the rules of war, the ideal set of rules of war, just is the morality of war. I think it's actually a familiar view in just war theory. I think Walter actually has something like this view in mind, that when we set up the laws of war to be a certain way and we respond appropriately to the facts that ought to shape the laws of war, that just is the morality of war. And a more recent exponent of this view is Henry Shue. A simple response to this view is that the law doesn't plausibly reflect or determine all of the rights and duties that people have during war any more than it does any other part of life. So when the laws of war are just silent on some matter, there's still a whole lot of morality out there. So it's not as if, you know, think about all the things that people do in war which are just unregulated. It's not as if somehow there's a moral vacuum with respect to all the rest of this stuff, breaching promises or cheating on your wife or all the other stuff that you could do whilst you're at war. It's not like, oh, well, because the laws of war don't say anything about this, then the rest of this is all permitted, which seems to be the kind of implication of this view. But also, one reason to reject this view is that when we shape the laws of war, we respond to people's perverse incentives and motivations. So we have to shape the law in a certain way in order to respond to the fact that people don't have ideal motivations. But the fact that they don't have ideal motivations doesn't affect what they're morally required to do. Think about a person who is never going to do what's right, and then there's two inferior options. And the best that we can do is get them to do the second best rather than the third best. So we set up the law to encourage them to do the second best rather than the third best, because we can't get them to do what's right. So it might be a good law that gets them to do the second best rather than the third best. That's the best we can do, because we can't shape a law in a way that gets them to do what's right. That doesn't make them permitted to do the second best. Second best is still the second best, it's still wrong. Law often is like this, I think. Often law is set up in a way that just tries to get people to do something that's better than they would otherwise do, where getting them to do what's right isn't really on the table because people are insufficiently motivated to comply with a law that gets them to do what's right. So that creates at least the theoretical space that we should have divergence. That divergence is created in order to get people to do something better than the worst option, where getting full compliance with morality is suboptimal, because if we try and get them to comply with morality, they'll do the third best. So in principle, I think we can get divergence. Now the question is whether we should get divergence in practice. So think about the law of self-defense in domestic criminal law, where in self-defense there's an imminence requirement. So you're only allowed to defend yourself if you're subject to an imminent attack. This rule is not convergent with morality. You're allowed to harm people when you're not subject to an imminent attack in morality. So if someone kidnaps me and they're going to kill me tomorrow, and there's nothing I can do other than kill them now to save my life, the fact that it's not imminent that they're going to kill me tomorrow doesn't make it impermissible for me to kill them now. But there might be perfectly good reasons for the criminal law to prohibit me killing the person now where it's non-imminent, because what we know is that, for example, in gang warfare, lots of people will say, look, we really needed to shoot these gang members now, because otherwise they were going to come after us next week and they were going to shoot us and our families, and so we had to do it now. And so gang members can utilize, and then we've got the presumption of innocence, and so it's really hard to prove that's not the case. And so gang members get off using self-defense too easily. And so we restrict the law of self-defense by putting an imminence requirement in place. And that seems perfectly sensible as a way of getting some kind of divergence between law and morality in order to ensure that the law of self-defense isn't abused in practice by people who are very violent. Okay, so when we think in more general terms about how we want to set up the law, we might think about what we should be trying to aim at, what we should be trying to achieve. The ultimate aim of the laws of armed conflict, I think, is to reduce the harmfulness of war. That's the primary ultimate aim. There are other things we want to try and achieve through the law too, but harm reduction seems like the most important thing. Some people think that we should only be aiming at reducing the amount of unjust harm that's caused, but we shouldn't be trying to reduce the amount of just harm that's caused. Shouldn't be preventing people from acting justly. But I think the view that says we shouldn't try and reduce the amount of just harm that's caused is mistaken. So I think we should be aiming at harm reduction more generally rather than just unjust harm reduction. So imagine that someone attacks me, and then you ought not to prevent me from defending myself. So that seems true, that we shouldn't prevent me from defending myself, even when my defending myself might be might cause more harm than it would cause if you prevented me. So suppose that Helen comes to attack me and she's going to render me very, very seriously disabled and I'm going to kill her. And let's suppose that it's permissible for me to kill her. If you stop me from killing her, that might achieve harm reduction. But it would be wrong to stop me from killing her, you might think, because I would be justly defending myself against this very violent attack. That seems right. But that doesn't give you the more general view that it's okay to reduce, that you should only aim at unjust harm reduction. Think about the state of affairs prior to a war, where you know that during the war, if it occurs, lots of unjust harm will occur, and then lots of the people who unjustly attack people will themselves be killed. Do we have a reason prior to the war to prevent people launching these unjust attacks in order to protect their lives from being lost, even though they'll be justly taken by the people that defend themselves against those people? And I think that the answer to that is yes. War often gives rise to lots of people launching unjust attacks. And when those people are killed, we should think of this as a kind of doubly regrettable state of affairs. It was bad for them that they were put in the social circumstances where they acted unjustly, and then even worse for them that they were killed as a result. So one very strong reason to try and eliminate wars is that wars tend to lead people to unjustly threaten others. Their lives will go worse in virtue of carrying out those threats, and they will also go worse if they're violently stopped from carrying out those threats. One very good reason not to try and avoid wars is that we prevent people from acting wrongly in this way. And that suggests we shouldn't just be aiming at preventing unjust harms, we should be aiming at preventing harms more generally, but subject to a restriction that we don't try and prevent people from acting permissibly. So we limit the extent to which we reduce harm by abiding by a restriction, that we don't prevent people from acting permissibly. I think that's the right view. Now, how do we do this? We do it by having a set of laws that has three functions, but I'm just really going to talk about two of them. So in this way, I think the laws of armed conflict are a bit like criminal laws. They have a guidance function, where the laws of armed conflict tell people how to act. And then there's an accountability function where we hold people to account when they violate the law. So one way in which they operate is a kind of ex-ante operation, where the laws of war set out a set of instructions to people about how to conduct themselves during war. And then when people violate, we hold them to account. And it's important to recognize the distinction between those things. It's not always true that everyone who violates a law and who then doesn't abide by the guidance function ought to be held to account for failing to comply. Indeed, international human rights law is very rarely enforced, but it's not completely ineffective as a result of being unenforced. And then we might think about different accountability structures that we can put in place which might have different effects on the extent to which the guidance function operates. Okay, so now let's think about whether convergence of law and morality, which prohibits people from fighting in unjust wars, will be successful in guiding people to behave better during war. Some people think it won't be effective because the burdens that people suffer during war make it very unlikely that they will comply with a law which prohibits them from fighting in unjust wars. They're scared, they're subject to duress, they're uncertain about whether the war is just or not, so they're subject to epistemic limitations and what they can understand. Often people who write like this, I think, conflate the extent to which the law that prevents them from fighting in unjust wars will be unfairly applied by adopting an accountability mechanism that will apply to them when they violate the law. So they say things like, look, it would be really unfair to hold people liable for fighting in unjust wars because they're subject to all these kinds of burdens. And then the response to that is just simply, we have all these mechanisms to deal with that. So we have a mens rea standard, we have some excuses available to people, we have prosecutorial discretion. There's lots of ways in which we can set up structures in a way that prevents people from being held accountable for violating the law. We don't need to say they're permitted in order to prevent unfair accountability. Furthermore, circumstances that people find themselves in during war vary enormously. Some people are subject to all of these constraints and others aren't. Some people are on the battlefield where there's lots of reasons for fear, they're subject to duress and all of that sort of stuff, and not everyone is in that position. Lots of people aren't in that position. And as we get more new technologies, fewer and fewer people are in that position. We've talked about drones earlier. People who are flying drone planes aren't in that position. So they don't have those kinds of excuses available to them. And also, of course, people decide often whether to go and fight or not. Now, some people are subject to very serious duress, which makes them go and fight, but lots of people who fight in wars aren't. And then if they get themselves into circumstances where they're fighting a war which is unjust and they had perfectly good reasons to work out that it was unjust in advance, now they go and fight the war and they say, look, I'm in this situation where I can't be expected to think for myself much because it's really scary here. The answer is you shouldn't have gone in the first place. About Walzer's weird attitude about Vietnam. He said, look, people had perfectly good reasons to vote against the war, but once they went, we couldn't hold them accountable for fighting. So he thought that all the protesters against the Vietnam War were quite right in protesting, but people who went and fought acted permissibly. It's just a bizarre set of attitudes. You can't just hold both these views. If people had good grounds to work out for themselves that the war was unjust in advance of going, and on that basis ought to have protested against the war, once they go and fight, and they don't respond to that evidence appropriately, you can't then say, oh, well, they're excused. That's just incoherent, I think. Jeff McMahon offers a different kind of reason why prohibiting just combatants will be ineffective. He thinks that all unjust combatants believe that their cause is just. And so a law that says don't fight in unjust wars will be ineffective because all the people who are fighting in unjust wars think they're fighting in just wars, and so they just won't think that the constraint applies to them. I think that's pessimistic. I mean, the first thing is that not everyone who fights an unjust war believes it to be just. Lots of people who fight unjust wars know that it's unjust, I think. Some people know they're fighting unjust wars all along, whereas others gradually come to realise that the war is unjust as it continues. So they start fighting a war which they think is just, and then they realise that it was a bad idea. Lots of people in Vietnam had that kind of experience. They started off thinking that the war was a just war, and then over the course of time came to realise that it wasn't. People in Afghanistan, I think, had a similar change in attitudes. Now, how would a law prohibiting fighting in unjust war affect these people? It wouldn't necessarily affect them in very large numbers, but it would affect some, I think, because as people came to realise that the war was unjust, and then they realised that now they're going to be in violation of the law for fighting, they would have a further reason to give up. And quite a lot of people during Vietnam became demotivated during the war and started to fight a lot less hard. And they would have now this extra reason why they should fight a lot less hard, because they would be in violation of the law. Particularly if you had an education system and NGOs and so on supporting people to respond in this way, that then helped people to recognise that when they realise the war is unjust, they ought to stop fighting. So my sense is that the overall capacity of a country to fight an unjust war would be reduced at least some degree if people had a prohibition in law on fighting unjust wars. Now, how much would it make a difference? Well, let's suppose it would make a difference of 0.1%. So it would affect 0.1% of people fighting in unjust wars. Well, 160 million people, I said earlier, died in wars in the 20th century. You don't have to be a maths whiz to realise that we're saving a lot of lives if we can just reduce by 0.1% the number of people who are fighting in unjust wars. That would be a big win in numbers, just by changing a law. Really doesn't make much odds to change a law. It's really easy, it's really cheap, and we could get a significant saving of lives, even if it had this only tiny effect on a small number of people proportionally. I think that would be enough to justify the law on its own. Furthermore, if you think your country's the kind of country that fights unjust wars, we can get NGOs on the ground who start to educate people about the fact that their country tends to fight unjust wars and discourage them from joining the military. a lot of the literature on this, I think, is kind of geared towards the incentives to people who are in the midst of fighting wars. But actually, I think that that is not the most important way in which we reduce the harmful effects of war. The most important way of reducing the harmful effects of war is to reduce the number of wars and to reduce their size and their duration. If we can reduce their size and their duration and the number of instances of wars, we're going to do much better than we are to try and regulate wars without reducing their size, number, and instance. Once wars start to get fought, it's really hard to alter people's behaviour during war for all the reasons that people who are in favour of divergence say. So then what and we know this from the fact that the Geneva Conventions have been so ineffective in reducing the number of non-combatants who are killed during war. The most important thing to do is to try and reduce the capacity of countries to fight wars. Now, there's a worry here, which is that you reduce the capacity of countries to fight wars asymmetrically. So some people say it's something like, look, the more liberal, law-compliant countries will reduce their capacity more than the countries that tend to be more unjust. And that's for the reason that there'll be more respect for international law amongst the countries that have more liberal institutions and more education than the countries that are not. And so what we'll do is we'll create this asymmetry where the countries that are more just will have less power than the countries that are less just. That seems like a legitimate concern if it's true. Again, I think this is unduly pessimistic. So when accountability practices and more regulation of police forces came into play in Britain, for example, it wasn't as if police effectiveness went down. On the contrary, it went up, I think. And one reason why I think it went up was because police officers then had more confidence that they were abiding by what morality and law required of them. When it was much less clear, then it was more chaotic and people acted on their own judgments much more without much confidence from the law, and so they became less effective. So my overall view, I think, is that more regulation and more accountability can go with more effectiveness. At least there's enough of a plausible case for that, I think, to respond to the asymmetry ejection. Of course, this is all empirical conjecture, but I don't think there's much on the surface of it to say in favour of the fact that the asymmetry that I pointed to earlier is going to be a significant problem. Some people say there's going to be biased and unjust enforcement of the law if we have the laws of war because countries will enforce themselves. We don't necessarily need to have an international law that permits this, though. You just prohibit enforcement by the states themselves. That seems like a perfectly effective way of responding to that concern. Some people say, well, there's a worry about this, that when people start to fight in wars, they're going to think to themselves, well, I might as well, if I'm going to already be in violation of the war for fighting, in violation of the law for fighting an unjust war, anything goes during war. It's like a kind of, I might as well be hanged for a sheep as a lamb kind of worry. If I'm already going to be hanged for a lamb, I might as well go and steal a sheep. That was a kind of worry. We have a similar problem in domestic criminal law. So if we, for example, prohibit burglary and murder, then people who burgle houses and who are then spotted by the homeowners have a reason to kill the homeowner because they think, look, I'm going to be punished anyway, so I might as well murder the homeowner because that way I'm going to reduce the chances of me getting punished at all because I'm going to kill this witness, and so then I'm going to be more likely to avoid punishment. Needless to say, not many people think that the right response to this is to permit burglary. They think something else, which is we just change the punishments for burglary and murder and make murder punished more severely than burglary. Same thing for fighting in unjust wars. So we might think that slaughtering civilians in villages gets a much higher penalty than participating in unjust wars. We might even have different accountability mechanisms, so we have more serious kind of international criminal law to deal with some violations, where we have other institutions to deal with others. Okay, so let me move on to the problem of people making causal contributions to wars. How long have I got left?
At least 5 minutes.
5 minutes, I do this super fast, okay? So we've got people who are making contributions to wars, and the question is whether it's permissible to kill them. And I've suggested that it might be permissible to kill them. But some people say we can't allow this to happen because we're going to increase the amount of killing in war as a result. But I think that's a mistake. Think about cases where you've got two different ways of pursuing an end. One which is going to kill some civilians who are going to build some munitions, or alternatively, you're going to wait till those munitions get to the front line and then you're going to kill people who are going to use the munitions. Everyone agrees that it's permissible to kill the people who use the munitions, let's say, but you might be able to kill fewer people by killing the people who are manufacturing the munitions to stop them getting to the front line. Here's an example from the Second World War. Towards the end of the Second World War, there was a debate between Goebbels and Speer. Goebbels wanted to get lots and lots of German young men, sometimes very young men, onto the front line. He thought the most effective thing to do towards the end of the war to maximize the chance of the Nazis succeeding was to get lots of young men onto the front line, whereas Speer thought that the important thing to do was to improve manufacturing. And that way we would get more munitions onto the front line, the Germans would get more munitions onto the front line, and that would be more effective. In the end, Speer won the argument and they put more resources into the munitions rather than putting people onto the front line. But imagine people thought, the Nazis thought to themselves, well, here's this extra advantage of getting more people to build the munitions. It's going to both be more effective and these people won't be liable to be killed. So they'll be protected under the laws of war. So we'll both be more effective and they'll be protected. That would be bizarre if the Nazis could protect their own citizens from being killed by making them more effective in this way. So I think there's some perverse incentives that come out from the law being set up at the moment. There's a bunch of cases that are like this. So you've got people who steal, there's a couple of people who stole oil tankers in Afghanistan, and then they were going to blow them up in, I think it was a post office they wanted to go and blow up in a town. If you could shoot them at the moment they were trying to steal the tankers, which is what some people did, that was in violation of the law because they were too far away from hostilities to be direct participants. So you had to wait until they got into the town, but obviously you're going to get a lot more collateral damage and a lot more deaths if you have to wait, so better to go earlier. Well, think about manufacturing of V2 bombs in World War II in Peenemünde, where targeting the people who were expert in developing the technology would have been far more effective in reducing threats of that the Nazis had through these rockets than trying to shoot people who were trying to use the rockets. You might think, oh, well, they could just bomb the facilities. Well, that's what they actually did, but it was quite easy to reconstruct the facilities later on. The important thing was that if you'd managed to kill the people who had the expertise, that would have prevented production of these rockets, which would have then saved possibly thousands of lives if that had been an option on the table, but that's prohibited by the law at the moment. So these look like serious problems. Now, there's lots of worries here that, as we know from recent cases involving terrorism, that we get overkill. That people think, oh, well, look, you know, anyone can count as participating in hostilities, and this is just used as an excuse. In the written paper, I draft a version of a law which I think is quite constrained, and we can even make it more constrained to get around this. I say something like, it's an offence to intentionally attack non-combatants during war, non-combatants being defined in the way earlier to do with causal steps. A person is entitled to a defence if attacking the person could reasonably be expected to prevent significant harm that would otherwise result from her contribution to military operations of a nation, state, or group engaged in an unjust war. Attacking the person was done only in order to prevent her from making that contribution and not in order to carry out reprisals or cause terror or alarm. And thirdly, a reasonable person would conclude that attacking this person was the least harmful means to avert the threats that would otherwise be posed as a result of the contribution. So that's just like a very crude draft law, which is intended to be quite constrained. It doesn't just allow you to kill any non-combatants. It has some quite distinct and constrained conditions, which I think would apply to the kinds of cases which I've laid out, but wouldn't have, I think, much effect in altering the behaviour of states. This isn't actually a million miles away from the law that is at the moment. It's just that it allows killing of people much earlier in the causal chain. Okay, let me end just by saying, of course, we've got no idea what the effects of, or very little idea of what effects changing the laws of war would have. Let me just give one final kind of thought that says something like this. Well, when we're thinking about the development of the laws of war and developing the institutions around the laws of war, as well as the ICC, and this is the point I was thinking about earlier, we should be thinking not just about now, we should be thinking about 200 years' time. We're in the very early stages of developing the laws of war and the institutions to support them. And what we do with the laws of war probably won't have very much effect for the next 20, 30, 40 years. But it might have a big effect on what happens later on. Think about the development of democracy as a similar kind of thing. When democracy, democratic systems get underway, they're very unjust, they don't work very effectively. But gradually the pressure of democratic systems is to move in the right direction when they're structured in the right way. And then eventually, much later on down the line, you can have effective democratic systems, but they have to evolve. It takes a long time to get them to evolve, and recent revolutions in like the Arab Spring, where they try and get democratic systems to run straight away, we can see often fail. Similar thing with the laws of war, but only if they're oriented in the right way. If we try and do all this game playing where we try and get divergence between law and morality in order to change incentives, the chances of the law evolving in the right way over the much longer term, I think, are much slimmer. And let me end there.